Welcome to Inspiring Stories for Bauer and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Hello, my name is Tim McMillan. Welcome to another episode of Inspiring Stories brought to you by Bauer and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. We are lucky to have our guest for this episode here with us in the studio. He's down here in Perth. He spends most of his time, though, up in the far northeastern part of the Kimberley, predominantly in Kununurra. He is an Aboriginal leader now of some decades. Ian Truss is his name, and earlier this year was recognised as one of only seven people in WA to be made an officer in the Order of Australia in the Queen's Birthday Honours. That is so Ian Truss AO after his name. So it's with great pleasure I say hello and welcome to Ian, and I'm looking forward to hearing not just your work with Wernand Corporation, Ian, but all about you as well and how you came to be in the position you're in at the moment.
Yeah, thanks, Tim.
How are you?
Yeah, good, good. It's been an honour sort of getting the award, of course.
Yeah.
And we attended the event last night out at Bull Creek at the Ruffa facility there.
Mm.
And there's lots of people there sort of receiving the award. And the first time I've been there a couple of times because there's the RAAF Museum right next door to it.
Yep.
And I've taken my my two grandchildren, their grandson, who are, you know, big sort of fans of, you know, the Air Force and anything sort of Army. We spent hours down there a couple of months ago and, you know, climbing through the old aircraft and so on. So
brilliant.
Yes, it's but I've been that part of it, not to where the event was last night.
You've received a lot of honours and accolades in your time. I imagine for you the real reward in what you're doing is seeing, you know, people improve their standing, their way of life up in your part of the world. But where does something like the Queen's Birthday Honours, you know, sit in your list of accolades that have been thrown your way?
Look, I think that's what I said to the awardees last night. I said that none of us sort of set out to actually, you know, to try and win an award.
Mm.
That's the last thing in your mind, really. What you try and do is do the best you can in what you do. And, you know, it's and there were people there last night in all sorts of different endeavours, sports and, you know, business and whatever. I was in the social and economic development of Aboriginal people. So, I think that it's a good achievement, and the fact that people do recognise you. Sometimes there's a saying that says that, you know, a prophet is a lot of times not recognised in your own land. I think there's quite a bit of truth to that.
Yeah.
You sort of, I've sort of been recognised from at a broader sense, but if you went back to locally, I heard this funny story about people saying, oh, you know, this, Ian Truss was walking on water. And, you know, the comment, you'd get back up there. Well, that's because the bastard doesn't know how to swim. But anyway, you know, it's not that I'm, any magician or anything, but it is sort of good to, you know, to be recognised. And I'm sure there's lots of other people out there that have done, you know, good things over the years as well. And, you know, they should be recognised as well.
Too many crocodiles in the parts of the world that you go to swim in, I'm imagining.
Exactly, yeah, that's right. So you definitely need to walk on water. So
yeah. You were obviously from the Kimberley. I understand you were born near Halls Creek. I'm keen to hear more about your family.
Yeah.
Your parents were part of the Stolen Generation. Is that something that you feel like you have come to terms with? Did you get to a point where you had processed that, or is that still an ongoing process for you?
No, look, my generation didn't need to come to terms with it at all, because my parents' generation came to terms with that. There's a great book called The 15%. It's written by a guy that was mounting the class action against the Catholic Church for child sexual abuse.
Uh-huh.
And he writes it on the percentage, from the basis of a 15% of all these thousands of people he interviewed, complainants about sexual abuse during their lifestyle, 15% who didn't carry that forward with them in their life. It didn't define their lives.
Mm.
And he tells a particular story there of this guy walking in, and he says, "Oh, look, I'm sorry, but because the whole case of the investigation, of course, was to mount a legal case." He walks in and says, "Look, I'm sorry, but you're going to find me a very bad witness." And the guy says, "You know, why?" And he says, "Well, I don't really carry any sort of animosity or hatred. I buried that years ago, and it's something that I haven't handed on to my children. and don't intend to or never have. So I'm sort of, I don't sort of obviously put ourselves as being in the same boat, but, you know, and my parents did went through some, you know, bad experiences when they were growing up. My mother got taken away when she was 6 years old.
Yeah.
And my father about the same age. She from Margaret River Station, which is about just over 100 k's south of Halls Creek. And Dad from Gogo Station, just 20 k's out of Fitzroy Crossing. But, you know, they both got taken away there from their families.
Where did they end up?
At Moolabulla, mm-hmm. which was a government settlement that was closed down in 1955. It was set up by the government in, I think, the early 1900s, and specifically for part Aboriginal kids, being, you know, being taken away from mainly sort of Aboriginal mothers. I mean, they obviously had non-Aboriginal fathers. So they ended up there in Moolabulla, along with a lot of other my cousins and so on. That all the people that were there, some of them they were related to, and a lot they weren't. And so I think that sort of relationship defined them to some extent. They sort of had this. They both went on a grade 5 education. That was the level, highest level of education that that educated Aboriginal kids at that time too. You couldn't go any further than that. You know, this was in the 1940s. But they could see the value of education as a result of that experience, and they wanted us to, you know, to try and be educated as much as we can. None of us, my generation, my brothers and sisters, apart from my sister Stephanie, who became a GP down here at University of WA. We didn't actually go to university. I did go to the South Australian Institute of Technology many years later, and did an associate diploma in social work. And my other, you know, a brother sort of was an electrician. Another one sort of did, you know, 3/4 of apprenticeship as a plumber, school teacher, and so on. So generally, our sort of family have done really well.
Mm.
And but we have, you know, did see, well, my parents did see the value of education, and that sort of, you can see that in our family history, I think.
Yeah.
And, but the hard times, you know, they say that, you know, hard times build, you know, breed sort of hard people. And that's true, I think, that, you know, and the reverse is true too, you know, soft, easy times, you know, breeds easy people. So that's probably what we're seeing now. And, you know, it tends to sort of go in a cycle, but we were basically kicked off Moolabulla Station in 1955 when the government, for whatever reason, decided to sell it.
Right.
Sell the property to private interest. They were given, I was only 5 years old at the time. I think my mother and father said they were given 24 hours notice.
To clear off?
To leave the station.
Wow.
You know, and heard it on the back of a truck, and basically we're sort of refugees and, you know, just nowhere to go. We ended up on the outskirts of Halls Creek. There was no accommodation. All we had was a tent, and, you know, my mum said we didn't even have a...
So you're thrown to the wolves.
Yeah, we just got the thing out, and nowhere. So we ended up in a tent on the outskirts of town, and I was 5 years old, and we and others went out to my uncle and auntie, ended up in one of the stations near Springvale Station, just out of Halls Creek. We eventually ended up in Broome after our staying in Halls Creek, and then from Halls Creek out from Broome, then went out to Glenroy Station and Mount House, which is in the central sort of west Kimberley.
Yeah.
But I, you know, it's funny that my mother and father haven't really, they don't really sort of dwell on it. In fact, they sort of, all the stories they tell us from that about their experiences on Moolabulla when they were a kid is about... really bad good things, you know. Mm. It's she did tell me a story that was quite, you know, it was quite sort of, well, not so much confronting, but sort of awakening, that when she was about 9, I think, must have been about three years after she got there. One of the older girls, because basically they had these older girls that were almost like surrogate mothers for them, went and woke her up, there's a... Every year, the Aboriginal sort of people, they still do it to some extent. They used to have this big, what they call law camps or corroboree camps around different parts of the country. And they went and told them, there's a big corroboree camp. It's about 3 k's from the station, from Moolabulla. We're going to we're going to sneak out tonight, because they weren't allowed after the curfew, they weren't allowed out the dormitory.
Yeah.
So we're going to sneak out tonight, and we're going to take you there to see your mum. And so she'd, you know, they snuck out at, you know, 7 or something, 8 o'clock or something from the thing, and then running across through the bush, they could see the campfires, and they could hear the didgeridoos in the distance towards where the Crobbery site was.
Mm.
And they got there. And my grandmother, Granny Wadebeer, her name was, they found her amongst all the group. There was about 50, 80, maybe 100 people there. She said some of them were sort of little campfires all over the place. Some of them were sort of dancing and singing. They found her there, and she come and, you know, Mum sat down there with hugging her and crying with her. And she said she had another young baby with her. But that, you know, sort of afterwards sort of found it years later. She never had a younger sister, so we assumed that baby had died.
Right.
So they only spent, there was only there for, they were only there for about 30 minutes, 30, 40 minutes, probably maybe less than 40 minutes, because the girls, you know, the older girls come and saw, said, look, we're going to have to get going now, otherwise we're going to get caught. So she went in sort of thing, and then gave her mother a kiss goodbye, and then they went back to the hostel, and she never saw her again.
Is that right?
That's right.
Not once?
She never saw her again. I mean, a few years later, then she died. We think it was in childbirth, because the Aboriginal women back then, you know, didn't go to a hospital to have children. They just had, you know, children out in the bush.
So you were literally born on station.
I was born in a clinic at Moolabulla Station. They did have a rudimentary clinic there with a nurse, I think. I don't know whether there's any doctors there, but probably a nurse. But the Aboriginal sort of, you know, women and my mother, for example, was born out in the bush. She wasn't born in a clinic. We were all, my generation, my brother and sister were all born in a clinic somewhere, or, you know, the younger ones in a hospital. But, yeah, so she died a few years later. And that was an eerie thing too, because, you know, sort of Mum was, she was about 12 or 13. I think it would have been about 1942 or 43, she was in the Wyndham Hospital. Wyndham had two hospitals. So Australia, up in the Kimberleys, was practicing a semi sort of apartheid sort of system. There was a white hospital in town. Wyndham's only a small town. You know, it's only about 1,500 or 1,200 people, but it also had an Aboriginal hostel, or Aboriginal hospital, and you wasn't allowed to go to the you know, the so-called white hospital unless you had your citizenship rights. And Mum, of course, didn't have that. And so she was down there for with sore eyes from Moolabulla. And I don't know, I think they took her down there by truck or something, just a two-wheel track back in those days.
Yeah.
And she said she was lying there, you know, and, you know, she was lying there half asleep and had this vision of her mother coming to her. She was telling me the story years later, and and she had, the mother sort of had a steel bar, because the Aboriginal women used to carry a steel bar for digging, for different, you know, sort of in the ground, they're digging for sort of seeds and yams and sort of different bush foods. They used to always carry the steel bar with them for digging around in sort of thing, and she had the steel bar with her. And Mum said she don't know if it was a vision or half a dream or what, but she sort of told her, oh, don't come to me, you know, you're dead, you know, I know that you died. And and because she had this really bad fever, really hot fever, really sweating and so on. And, you know, her mother said that her mum put her hand in her forehead. And then she got up about half an hour later and the fever was completely gone.
Wow.
And she got up in the morning and she said, oh, I don't know, what happened? What was that about? You know, I sort of might have been dreaming. But when she looked on the side of her bed, the steel bar was lying there on the concrete floor. She said, well, you know, where'd that come from?
Yeah. So,
but anyways, just those little things that, you know, she had told some fascinating story. I mean, it was also while she was there, they had to get out of the hospital because the Japanese bombed Wyndham.
Mm.
This was in 1942, and, you know, we're attacking from, I think they had a base in Timor or somewhere, and they attacked Wyndham there at the time. So Mum had to, and all the other people had to get out of the hospital, and everybody was, you know, evacuating Wyndham because they got some sort of advance notice that they were, you know, must have been from radio message from Darwin or somewhere.
Yeah.
And so they got out of town, and they could see the little, you know, big black smoke from from Wyndham and when the Japanese were bombing there.
Incredible. Everyone thinks of Darwin, don't they? They forget that the northern parts of the WA coast got peppered,
you know,
as well.
Exactly. Sort of Broome as well was attacked. Yep. I think there were, I think a few people got killed there with, Dutch sort of evacuees from Timor and Java, and also Colombo was attacked as well.
Yep.
I think a couple of priests and someone were killed there because from Japanese attack. They were actually looking for the Truscott Air Base. The Truscott Air Base was only about 20 minutes flying from Colombo, and the Japanese, I think, we knew that it was there. And when they attacked from thing, but they flew over Colombo, and they assumed that was it. But, Truscott was another 15, 20 minutes flying, but they never found it, apparently.
Well, that's good. Thank goodness for that.
Yes, they never found it. So
yeah.
It was disbanded, sort of 6 months later when the war sort of moved on and, and the threat to that part of Australia sort of evaporated. So it wasn't needed anymore. And then they moved on to Darwin or somewhere.
Yeah. Found a bigger target.
Yeah.
And we need to take a break. Yeah. But after that, before we get into all of your incredible work with Wooden Foundation, I'm just keen to hear how life has been during COVID up in Kununurra. It's been a bizarre time for everyone, but I can imagine up in a more extreme environment and landscape that you call home, things have been even more different. So we'll get into that right after we take a break. Ian Trust, AO, is our special guest in this episode of Inspiring Stories. Back with more in just a moment.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. This one is brought to you by Bowra and O'Day. The story we are hearing is the story of Ian Trust. Ian, I mentioned earlier that we're lucky to have you here in the studio here in Perth. I know you spend the vast majority of your time up in Kununurra. Do you enjoy being in the big smoke?
Yes, look, it's always a great, break to come down here. Sort of slightly cooler weather usually, or sometimes it is quite cold, of course, but I don't mind that.
Mm.
And come up, I've got lots of contacts and people I've got to come and do business with down here anyway. And I normally come down every, I don't know, maybe 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And for different things.
Yeah.
I'm down here for two reasons this week. I attended the AO Order of Australia celebration last night at Ball Creek. With the WA sort of chapter of the organisation recognises all the recipients, and but I'm also on the board of the Water Corp Customer Advisory Committee.
Right,
and we've got a meeting on this afternoon, so I tend to come down for the different sorts of things, and they all sort of add a bit of variety to what I do, and. But all in some ways sort of connected to what I'm trying to do, and which is, trying to empower Aboriginal people and create a better life for them, and that's what I'm about with my job at one end.
It sounds like such a simple mission when you state it like that, but obviously we know the issues underpinning that are very, very complex and difficult. We'll get into that over the course of the next little while. But can you just tell us what life has been like in Kununurra for the last 18 months or so? I mean, people get very caught up in their own kind of personal issues here in the city, but I dare say you've got a different set of challenges going on in Kununurra and that general part of the Kimberley. How has it been?
Look, it hasn't been too bad. I'm probably the wrong person to ask, really, because I'm a guy that, I don't go to the pub too often, and I'm not sort of into social living anyway, so I haven't really noticed too much difference.
and tourists, are you seeing a lot of first-time tourists to that part of WA?
We've seen huge amounts of tourists, which is great for the local economy. I mean, I've got a... My sort of family's got a local, we've got a tourist sort of camp area, sort of about 55 k's from Kununurra, and we've absolutely been inundated with people coming and staying there, and absolutely loving it. So I know it's in a positive way. The COVID situation is probably, I mean, I know there's lots of small businesses hurting a bit because of a downturn in what's thing, and they haven't been able to do it. But in terms of the tourism industry, and in more recent months anyway, there's been a huge numbers coming through places like Kununurra and Broome and so on.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that's good. Yeah. Plenty of food on the shelves still?
No, not really. Well, sometimes there is, but, you know, I mean, I'm pretty sure they've got it under control, but, you know, even the local sort of supermarkets there, Coles and the IGA, they've sort of, you know, there's been pretty lean on the shelves there a few times, and I've gone in there to buy things, and there's been, you know, there's cooking all day, but, you know, it's only, you know, only sort of 2 gallons sort of amount.
Let's go back to your younger days then. I'm keen to know where, I suppose, your social awareness, your social conscience started to transform into what has become your professional life.
Mm, yeah.
And where your time as a diesel mechanic sits in there as well, because I understand that was a skill that you picked up along the way. Did the two have to coexist for a while until one basically took priority?
Yeah, look, when I left school, I think that, you know, I'm talking about the late 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't very many opportunities in Wyndham because we moved from Halls Creek to Wyndham, and my family, you know, the first time in our life that we'd actually had a house and could settle down in. But there weren't very many opportunities in Wyndham at the time. But I took up did an apprenticeship as a diesel fitter with the Department of Mechanical Plant Engineering, which is part of the Public Works Department.
Yep.
And I totally enjoyed that. I mean, I think that, you know, I had a great lots of work. Mates to work with, mainly there was a few Aboriginal people there, but all the mechanics were predominantly non-Indigenous. And, you know, there's a German there and Yugoslav and a few other, you know, sort of ethnic people from around the world. And totally enjoyed that. I think that and I probably would have stayed in that profession, but what happened in the 70s, Aboriginal affairs started to emerge in terms of Aboriginal community development, in terms of economic development. You know, getting people to, in terms of ramping up, getting people to sort of embrace more education and so on, and also economic engagement in regard to jobs and so on. That had quite a bit of appeal to me. I liked that. And I remember there was a job going, there's two jobs going. One was in this new Aboriginal affairs field, and there was also a job going as a diesel fitter at the copper mine up near Bougainville, near New Guinea.
Mm.
And there was a job going there for a diesel fitter, which was fairly, you know, fairly high wages. And I was thinking, well, which one should I go for? I probably, you know, could have got the diesel fitter one quite easily. I mean, it was right down my alley and I had the qualification and so on. But decided to take the Aboriginal one, mainly because I took a cut in pay. But it was an area that I sort of wanted to develop into.
Mm.
It's I sort of saw more scope there for it, and also the other thing that interested me quite a bit, even though I didn't have much skills at the time, was in terms of economic development and finance. And so we applied for, myself and my sister applied for the jobs with Aboriginal Affairs. We both got appointed, and I took up a position in Port Hedland, and she took up a position down here in Perth.
Yep.
And we were both living in Wyndham at the time. And that's where it started, really. I think that, and at the time when I look back in regards to what was being done in Aboriginal Affairs was pretty basic. There was no money involved.
Yeah.
And I went around to these little groups in Roebourne and Port Hedland and Meekatharra with these little, mainly sort of women. Basically, they were sort of sewing classes, really. And, you know, we might have had to offer them, a $1,200, $1,500 grant here and there. So it was only just started. And but that was an area that I started to get more interested in, but one good thing about my diesel training that I thought sort of found useful in terms of what I was doing with Aboriginal Affairs is it did sort of teach you how to think in a systematic way. Like if you're tracking back a problem as to why an engine doesn't work, you've got to be, you know, you got to look back, you've got to sort of think about the system. Okay, well, if, you know, you test this, that doesn't work, track it back as if that doesn't work, and, you know, until you eventually find the cause.
Mm.
So I've sort of tended to use that sort of
methodical way of approaching it.
Yeah, of a methodical way of trying to approach something as to how we, you know, you keep on cutting off the things that don't work until you find something that does. So.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's the reason why I sort of ended up in Aboriginal Affairs, and like I said, it was before the advent also of native title, of course.
Yeah,
and
I mean, a lot has changed in terms of the structures around Aboriginal Affairs policies and funding programs and the like. The social issues that that are at the root of all the the challenges, not just in the Kimberley, but across the country, have they changed a lot, or you find you're still having a lot of the same conversations, or parts of those conversations are still the same now as they were decades ago?
Look, I think the problems have compounded in more recent years, mainly because things like alcohol, drugs, lack of housing, jobs and so on, it's actually compounded the issue. That's why it's sort of...
Those factors are even more prominent and prevalent now.
Oh, very much so. I think that, it's sort of like kids coming through school now. It's, this is the funny thing, is there's huge amounts of opportunities. But there's lots of kids who've got to struggle with all the different, different issues. Like if you look at the... 98%, they tell me 98% of the inmates at Broome Prison is Aboriginal.
98%?
98%, and 98% of that 98% is, for domestic violence.
Yeah.
So it's a, that just gives you the, the problem, the extent of the problem that we have. And it's probably, and whether it is the problem or the symptoms of a problem is another issue. And I think that there's, there are heaps of organisations and programs all trying to work to try and address it, and we haven't sort of quite worked out there are some good things that are being done, and we're spending $32 billion a year on this problem. I mean, that's what they keep telling you about closing the gap in terms of where this money being spent and what's being achieved from it.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a lot of goodwill there from the Australian community and governments generally in terms of trying to provide good services and provide a better future for Aboriginal people and Aboriginal children. And there's lots of good people working in that space, but I think we've still got a fair way to go in terms of, getting better upkeep, uptake in regards to some of our programs.
Yeah. You would have had to speak to... ask tough questions of, deal with politicians of all walks of life. Do you like politicians?
Look, the system we have is a democratic system where you've got to go through certain processes to achieve something. And a lot of times it's 10 steps forward and 8.5 steps backwards. And,
What I'm getting, do you often feel like you're getting lip service from them without genuine intent?
Look, I think a lot of them sort of are sort of genuinely sort of, they are sort of genuinely concerned about the issues. And I think there's from, both sides of the, from the two major parties that are wanting to see, bringing people do well. They've probably got differing views as to how you try and achieve that.
Yeah.
I sort of come in the camp of people are, we're going to have to make some hard decisions in terms of welfare reform, alcohol and so on, and providing opportunities and jobs and housing as well. I mean, I think it's almost like this, it's almost like seeing this jigsaw puzzle view of what success looks like. You've got that many players involved that they've all got sort of to put that picture together on this jigsaw, put this puzzle together. Different people see different aspects, or giving emphasis to certain programs over others. And it's not to say that they're absolutely that they're wrong. It's just a matter of how you look at it. And because someone once said that how you sort of see a problem is defines on how you try and fix it. But look, I think there's generally lots of goodwill. I mean, I think I'm not sort of you got to work with who's in power at the time.
Yeah, got to be flexible.
You got to be flexible. They're all sort of wanting to look at, willing to fund this and, fund that or do this or do that. And I think that's fine. It's just that we probably, if you look back at the amount of money that's in the system now in 2021 compared to what it was in 1967 or, late in the 70s, there's probably 200% more than what it is.
Yeah.
More.
Yeah. And yet I know that one of your goals with Woonan Corporation is to get people off welfare and out of that cycle and to empower them to find other means to sustain themselves. Maybe that's a question I need to get you to explore in more detail in just a moment, but we'll take a break, Ian. We'll get into that right after that. And as well, I know you've not been immune to wading into some controversial areas as well, like the cashless debit card, but again, we'll hold that over until after we hear from our sponsors. This is Inspiring Stories. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Ian Trust AO is the guest in this episode of Inspiring Stories. Ian is the founder and chairman of the Woonan Foundation. You've got so many other roles that you've held, still do, have held in the past. Ian, I could be here all hour just listing those. But Woonan Foundation obviously is very close to your heart. It's such a big part of your life. For those who haven't heard of Woonan Foundation, just give us a snapshot. What is it and what are you out trying to achieve?
Well, the Woonan Foundation is a charity that we've set up about 25 years ago. It's based in the East Kimberley. We cover programs throughout West Kimberley, and we've also got some people working for us here in Perth as well. We run a boarding hostel in Sydney. We've got a research company in Melbourne. But essentially, it's about trying to empower Aboriginal people to take up opportunities in terms of jobs and, you know, through jobs and education and become part of the mainstream economy, lead independent lives, just like anybody else, really.
Yeah.
And but still retaining our cultural values in terms of where, you know, what we believe in and where we've come from, not leaving that behind.
Is that a complicated part of the vision, if you like, being able to, I suppose, really embrace culture and heritage and country and place at the same time, trying to measure yourself up against this other kind of success? Is it hard to kind of marry the two and keep a foot in both camps there?
I think some people might struggle with it. I mean, but someone sort of said to me once that, look, you could have a university degree and be practicing your culture. There's no sort of, you know, there's no reason why there's got to be a division between the two. It depends on how you think. It's a bit like you take the Jewish businessman.
Yeah.
I mean, the Jewish, you know, with the Jews, they, you know, they're very much sort of part of their culture, but they sort of embrace it part of the, you know, mainstream and business as well. So using that as an example, there's no reason why we can't do the same thing. I mean, there's some aspects in terms of where you've got cultural obligations and you've got to go back to do things on country thing, but you know, you try and sort of, you know, you've got to measure that in with factor that in with what you're doing. And obviously, if you're running a business, then you've got to be careful, you know, you've got to be mindful of the fact, well, how's this going to affect my business? And, you know, you've got to sort of manage for that. So I don't think it's something that it's got to be either or.
No, exactly. Yeah, I think some people view it that way, though, don't they? So you can't necessarily have both. They don't always coexist, you know, in synergy.
That's right. No, I don't think it's going to, you know, it does need to be either or. I think we can sort of do where we can, you know, our people up there, they call it being able to walk in two worlds.
Mm.
And I see, you know, people at the Kimberley Land Council, you know, annual general meetings walking around with these T-shirts on that says we've got to walk in two worlds. Well, that's exactly what they mean. And absolutely, I think that's what it's about. And I think it's just that some groups have done it better than others. It's mainly because they've been more innovative, I suppose. And, you know, but it's, you know, we're part of 21st century Australia, and there's lots of our younger people. You know, the lifestyle they're living is very much, you wouldn't sort of see the difference much with, you know, any sort of young person in Perth or Sydney.
Yep.
You know, it's exactly the same lifestyle.
Mm.
But we do want to retain it. It's part of our identity as to who we are. And I think that's important that we do that. And, but you can do it in a positive way that, you know, and still walk in these two worlds, basically.
Yeah. Mm. So what's the secret to empowerment? At least, you know, up in your part of the Kimberley.
Well, the secret for empowerment for me is, you know, empowerment really is about taking responsibility for yourself and your life. I mean, that's not an Aboriginal thing. It's, you know, it's just a human thing. If you don't take responsibility, then you're leaving it in the hands of others to take responsibility for you. And, you know, you can't then complain about, well, I didn't like this, I didn't like that. Well, then you've got to take responsibility yourself. So that for me, it's about responsibility and, you know, success equals, you know, responsibility. It takes discipline and it also takes sacrifice. Everyone that, you know, whether you want to lose weight or something, or, you know, you've got to sacrifice something, otherwise you can't, it can't succeed. And then, you know, that almost goes for anything in life. So I think they're the sort of things that we're wanting to do. And it's, like I said, it's not specifically an Aboriginal thing. It's a human thing. And some people struggle with it and some people don't. But, you know, I think that's really the key of how we're trying to get people to take responsibility for themselves, own their own homes, you know, build a, get their kids to live a really nice, safe sort of lifestyle, enjoy the benefits that, you know, all the every other Australian or most other Australians enjoy. And it's very much sort of in, you know, within their grasp. So, you know, it's just a matter of helping them along the way to achieve it.
Yeah. And part of your quest along the way has included you, as I mentioned, wading into a fairly controversial topic in the cashless debit card, which was really given real focus in the news cycle, at least, when, you know, people like Andrew Twiggy Forrest got involved a few years ago. Tell me about your stance on the cashless debit card and why it's been a topic that you have, you know, been willing to put yourself out there and, let's be honest, polarise some people along the way. Yeah. Why is it such an important topic for you?
Well, I think if you were to do an assessment of the many of our families in the Kimberleys, you'll find that they've been, you know, dependent on welfare for 2, 3, and 4 generations. And that can't be. In a country that offers so many opportunities like Australia. So I think that for our, you know, for our sort of leadership, you know, at the political leadership as well, that can't be accepted, that, you know, 4 or 5 generations down the track, there's a big section of this community is on welfare. There's a big section, 98% is in prison because of domestic violence. There's a big problem with alcohol. So I think that they're the challenges that we've got to face up to. And unless we address things like alcohol and why are these people sort of, you know, 4 or 5 generations on welfare, until we sort of face up to those problems, we're never going to be able to fix it.
Mm.
And what we're doing at the moment is we're spending huge amounts of money. You know, they're telling us, you know, there's $32 billion, you know, sort of being spent on closing the gap. And I think that we've got a mindset that somehow money will fix it. I'm not convinced that's always the case. I mean, money's important, but not necessarily going to fix it.
Mm.
So I think that there's got to be an honest look as to what we do. One thing I'll commend is that, you know, the WA government, I attended a committee meeting down here about a month ago. They're talking about sort of having a very sort of ambitious plans about, you know, reducing the domestic violence rate by 50%, increasing child school attendance by 50% and so on, which is all very ambitious. And I hope that we can achieve those things. But they're the sort of bold things that you've got to do to bring about change. And you know, if there's a political will from government to try and achieve that, and we can get strong Aboriginal leadership to back it, then we're on a path of actually trying to achieve something.
Yeah. Mm. What does it mean for you personally having someone of the clout, if I can put it that way, of Andrew Forrest sort of, you know, walking hand in hand with you to, you know, march to Canberra
and make
these sorts of bold demands?
That's right. Well, Andrew's been a big supporter of this, and but it probably needs broader support as well. I mean, and there's, you know, there is sort of broader support across the political spectrum for this. It's just that it's with some of our people, it's not, you know, they're not sort of they haven't come to the forefront in regards to expressing their support. But I think that there's a saying that says that if you want to have things you've never had before, you've got to be prepared to do things you've never done before. And that's basically what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're wasting your time with everything else.
Yeah.
You know, and it kind of means sort of making some hard decisions, doing some hard things that some people won't like.
Yeah.
But if you're happy with 98%, you know, people in prison for domestic violence, you're happy with, 50% of, you know, some of the little kids sitting in the classroom with FASD because of the lifestyle, their families are living, well, then, we're going to have to make some hard decisions.
Yeah, You must have made yourself a target along the way, though, to some. You must have had some people who vented strongly in your direction.
Look, I'll tell you what, I'll tell you, the Aboriginal people in Kununurra, it's... generally sort of they'll sort of go along with what's, you know, if they think that you're straight down the line, that you're coming up with something that's going to be good for the long term. And I think that's one of the problems, is that people don't see that, you know, the good that we're going to do in the long term.
Yeah.
They just sort of see the immediate thing. It's a bit like telling your kids, you know, you need to stop, you know, eating too many lollies or drinking too much Coke, you know.
Yeah, they miss the sugar hit, but they get rewards
exactly.
in the long
so
term.
There is a, you know, sometimes it's hard for people to see the longer term thing, but, you know, responsibility and giving people the power to actually make their decisions yeah. is what we're on about.
Yeah.
But we're going to have to sort of go through some, you know, tough sort of hurdles to get there.
Absolutely. Ian, we need to head to another break. Ian Trust AO is our special guest. This is Inspiring Stories. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bower and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bower and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Kununurra leader Ian Trust is our guest in this episode. We are lucky enough to have him in Perth at the moment. Ian, I think a lot of people, including you know, media and its assorted commentators, are guilty sometimes of focusing on negative outcomes, poor statistics, that sort of thing. I'm sure that's frustrating to you, but tell me now about some of the great achievements, the things that you celebrate, particularly with Woonan Foundation, but things that, you know, have really caught your eye and I suppose have been markers of progress in your eyes.
Yes, it's, you know, I think some of the things we've done is that, and a lot of it's sort of like about personal journeys. And, you know, we've just recently constructed a new medical service, which we've got a very generous donation from Lottery West. Thanks to them. They've been a great partner of ours over many years. So we've got a private, I think it's the only Aboriginal private practice in WA. I'd probably be corrected on that, but I think it is.
And this is Woonan Foundation?
Woonan Foundation. We own a private medical practice. I think we've got four doctors there. And, you know, we provide a medical service for the whole town, not just the Aboriginal community. Because there is an Aboriginal medical service in town as well, of course. But my sister's the chief medical officer there, and she studied, you know, became a GP through UWA about 12 years ago. Might have been a bit more, 15 years ago. But that's been one of our success stories, and you know, the one end board is working on trying to make it get it better. And we're looking at sort of, you know, key partnerships with other organisation. We partner with an organisation up there called Boab Health.
Mm-hmm.
We also house the rural health school. They sort of operate from our clinic as well, where trainee doctors come and they work through there, and they go on, you know, work for our medical service, the hospital, and the medical service, and so on. So we've done some good things there, and one of the key programs we've developed, which we don't actually run at the moment, is transitional housing. We wrote up the program for that and sold that to the state government. So transitional housing, where you get a house, but the house comes with certain obligations. The two major obligations are that you've got to have a job or be in education or moving towards getting a job, and your kid's got to be going to school 80% plus of the time, plus it can't be a party house. And eventually we also like those, you know, the tenants of those houses to become homeowners, to buy their house, well, you know, that house, or buy a house. But that's another great program that we've done, worked in over the years, and, you know, it's been... but that's only worked because we've had great partnership with government and other sort of parties as well. And but one end's, you know, in the business of trying to change people's lives, and we've sort of tried to find anything that we could try and do that. And and we've had some successes here and there with, you know, different programs, but they're just some examples of ones we have.
Yeah,
done. Yeah.
Fantastic. Who are the people that have inspired you through your life, Ian?
Well, I suppose my mother and father, sort of in the first instance. But, you know, I've had sort of a few mentors, like in the days when I was doing my apprenticeship, the guy who was the foreman at the workshop there, Les Simpson. He's died now. Les's family lives in just out of Mandurah, and but Les was basically I was a family friend before sort of I started. You know, we used to live across the road from them, and I used to, you know, his son and or his kids used to come across and playing at our place all the time, and vice versa. So Les was an important thing of mine in terms of growing up, and we're doing my apprenticeship. you know, some of my relatives, well, my mum and dad, and my uncle Sam Butters was another one. Auntie Jane Butters, her which is dad's sister. You know, she was a big sort of part of my life. I used to sort of always stay with them out of the station and so on. And later on, it's been, you know, I've got lots of non-Indigenous people and Aboriginal people who I sort of see as being my mentors now. Mm. I mean, Troy, you met there earlier, is one of the people I sort of connect with and you know, ask, get his opinion of things. And so I've got quite a few people that I connect with and get advice from. And because, you know, I don't sort of see myself as being an expert in everything.
I mean, as leaders go, there's no one type of leader, is there? You're not a classic orator as a leader, are you?
Yeah,
you're a little more unassuming, a little quieter. In terms of the great leaders, though, that have had an impact on you, are there any that stand out and come to mind?
Look, I think that I've sort of you know, I like the notion that good leaders are builders.
Mm.
They build something.
Yeah. They're not just
people who
loud,
talk.
Yeah, you know, people with grab the megaphone and yell.
That's right. They're sort of people that are sort of, you know, they actually build something. And like, you know, you take Nelson Mandela, for example, you know, after the fall of apartheid in South Africa and the ANC had won government, there's a, you know, it's exactly the same thing happening now with Afghanistan. There was a general sort of feeling, oh, well, now that we're in power here, you know, we're gonna make these bastards pay for, you know, 150 years of, you know, apartheid and so on. But, you know, his sort of position was, no, we've got to, you know, it's about sort of winning the peace.
Mm.
It's about reinventing what South Africa is. It's a bit like what, you know, with, you know, it's a bit like what MacArthur did, you know, after the fall of Japan. You know, he had to sort of win the peace and reinvent the country. So I think that they're the skills that sort of intrigued me as to how you do that. I mean, you know, Martin Luther King, of course, it was another issue in terms of, you know, extra sort of racism.
Mm.
How do you sort of build that? You know, people being standing up for what they believe in. You know, another guy that sort of was intrigued in reading his story was John Brown, who was anti-slavery thing in the US, and he was actually hung. He was white. He was a white farmer, and you know, he was hung for his position on being anti-slavery.
Mm.
He was hung by the you know, the Southern states. But that was the trigger for the American Civil War, that resulted in, you know, the overturn of slavery. But, you know, sort of people that sort of stood up against what they thought. I mean, another sort of two people that really sort of thing me was, you know, Sophie Scholl, you know, the young German 18-year-old who stood against Adolf Hitler. About, you know, you can't do this. You know, they just killed 300,000 people, you know, Jews in Poland. And, you know, we don't, you know, civilized societies don't do that. And, she was executed along with her brother. But for people who sort of stood up against, you know, a sea of sort of brown shirts in that case.
Yeah.
And expressed their opinion.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. And when you go back to Kununurra, I know your time in Perth is fleeting on this occasion. Yeah, but when you get back and you think, I'm home. What are the things about home? If you could capture the essence of Kununurra, what is it that makes it feel like home for you?
Well, I think it's mainly sort of family. I think that's the thing about being home. It's really sort of where your family is, and, you know, sometimes that's always not a positive either, especially for, you know, some of your, you know, grandkids waiting there for a handout. That comes with being this home feeling.
Yeah.
But no, it's really sort of, you know, family and friends. And but, you know, I don't think it's really sort of that sort of, you know, that's the thing of home, of, you know, the sense of belonging.
Yeah.
Of that home sort of gives you. And but, you know, if I've got friends all around Australia, and I sort of, even when I meet up with friends, you know, over in Sydney or somewhere else that I haven't seen for a while, I look forward to sitting down, you know, having a meal or a coffee or something with them. Now, you know, I look forward to that as well. And because when you look back over your life, you know, I've just turned 70 early this year. When you look at back over your life over time, and you sort of say, well, you know, these are the people that actually sort of helped to mold me and contributed to my sort of, you know, my vision and sort of thing on how you sort of see people. And it's all very important that how you sort of see that. And in time, you sort of, I think, you know, that's how you sort of grow.
And lastly, Ian, you mentioned that you're now 70. You know, we can't work forever. At no. some point, we've got to scale things back a little bit. What's left for you to achieve? What would you really like to be able to hang your hat on by the time your full-time work, your Woonan Foundation directorship comes to an end?
Look, I think I can't see myself sitting at home and just watching TV.
Mm.
You know, I think that's when you die. You've got to have an interest in something. So I don't see myself sort of thing. I'd probably carry on doing certain sort of things, even though it's not maybe not sort of working full time. I haven't sort of set a date on that just yet. There are sort of capable people sort of can wake up. I think it was one of the ex-Israeli prime ministers who said that the graveyard is full of people who are indispensable. So there's probably a bit of truth to that. So I don't see myself as being indispensable.
Yeah.
But during the time I've been there, I think I've brought some value to, what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
Some clarity to what we need to do.
Yeah.
And I just hope that, some of the people waiting in the wings are going to take that forward and, achieve better outcomes than I did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose it's all about empowerment. So if that's your lasting legacy, then job done, Ian. But we're not calling time on that yet, not by a long shot. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story with us, Ian.
Thank you very much.
All the best with all of your future endeavours with Woonan Corporation and all the various other entities that you're also a part of as well. So
thank you.
Thank you again for coming in and sharing your time with us in this program. Thank you. You've been listening to Inspiring Stories here on 882 6PR. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. We look forward to you joining us next time as we unearth another inspiring story.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.